Hi everybody, good morning, are we ready? Shana Tova everyone, thanks very much for coming. There is an old joke about Tom Gedalia, which is that after 2 days of Chag, and certainly three in our case, then Chazal needed to find any excuse for a fast day, so they looked throughout Jewish history, let's find some tragedy which we haven't assigned a fast day for, and they found some Gedalia so that everybody could detox a little bit. So obviously we'll be trying to provide something slightly more than that, but thanks very much for coming. When Rafi asked me quite a few months ago if there was anything that I had in mind that I'd like to speak about for Tom Gedalia, I immediately gave a title, something along these lines, From Gedalia to Rabin, which is sort of something that I guess I've been thinking about on and off for many, many years. It combines for me a lot of my different interests, Jewish history, Jewish thought, politics, political philosophy, modern Israel. And only when I actually sort of got down to putting it together did I realize how enormously wide the title was, and that we've only got an hour. So it's going to be very broad what we're going to talk about, and in order to catch the most important general themes, we're inevitably going to miss some of the specifics. Even though the first part of the title says From Gedalia to Rabin, the second part of the title says Political Violence in Modern Israel, so I've already cut out several thousand years just in the shift from the beginning of the title to the end of the title. And even within the end of the title, there's no way, sadly, in which I can speak about everything. But let me give a broad overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to give two broad themes, both a specific Jewish one and then a general one, for understanding conflict, for understanding internal societal conflict. And then I'm going to focus on three different periods or instances within Israeli history, slightly before Israeli history, pre-state, so specifically the 1930s and the 1940s and the different paramilitary groups in Israel at the time. Then in order to provide a contrast, I'm going to speak about Haredi violence, both Haredi against the wider Israeli society and internal Haredi violence. And then, of course, the road to Rabin, and then conclusions. This means there's lots that I'm not going to speak about. So I'm not going to speak about Sephardi violence in the 1950s. Israel had its own Black Panther movement. That's what it was called, styled on the American Black Panthers. I'm not going to talk about the far-left radical activities of the 60s and 70s, a group called Matzpun. These are what I'm going to focus on. If anyone wants general reading, obviously each period has got lots of great works written about each period. So if you're interested in a specific period, please do come and ask. But the great master of, the great scholar of political violence, radical violence in Israel, is a man called Ehud Sprinzak, who passed away in 2005, I believe. He was an academic at Tel Aviv. He's written a number of books, but his best known and his most all-encompassing book is called, it translated into English, very nice translation, called Brother Against Brother, which really is extremely extremely comprehensive. Let's begin. Two broad themes, and let's take the first theme. People here familiar with Yossi Klein Halevi, author of Like Dreamers? So I knew Yossi Klein Halevi before he was famous, and I was invited to have a coffee with him after I got to know a friend of his back in 2006, and I wanted to speak to him about various things. We had the most amazing conversation, in which we came up with the following. There are two psukim in Tanakh, two events in biblical history, which seem to capture two very distinct and competing takes on Jewish history. The first one is as follows. In the middle, towards the end of Bamidbar, Balak, the king, summons the prophet Bilam in order to curse Israel as they pass through the desert. And within the midst, of course, Bilam is not able to give the curse. Instead, he gives the blessing. But a lot of the blessings have a sort of interesting, ambiguous nature to them. One of the verses is as follows: Hen amal avadad yishkon. They are a nation that dwells alone, Uvagoyim lo yitchashev, and they shall not be counted, they shall not be considered amongst the nations. In other words, or at least one take on this pasuk is as follows: Jewish history is unique. Jewish history is exceptional. Jewish history should not be counted like other nations. It works along and with its own rhythms. We shouldn't try and define ourselves in relationship to other nations. Thus is Bilam's blessing. Hundreds of years later, we are now in Nevi'im, we are post Chumash, and the people come to Shmuel the prophet, and they say to him as follows: Sima lanu melech leshafteinu, appoint for us a king over us to judge us. Give us a king. We've been hundreds of years as a people post leaving Egypt, yet we have never had a king. Give us a king. V'hayinu gam anachnu kuchol hagoyim, and we will be like all the nations. And what this verse seems to capture is this other take on Jewish history, which is actually an attempt to live our lives and build our society and live our history like and in accordance with the rest of the world, the rest of them, to not be abnormal, rather to be normal. That is the aspiration. And in fact, you can really use this idea, are we exceptional or are we striving to be normal, as one of the most useful prisms for looking at Jewish history. And you can think back, you know, different periods, be it the Hasmonean period and what became the Hanukkah story, be it the Haskalah, as representing different tensions within this overall tension. And the genius of Zionism lay in the possibility of reconciling these two ideas. Zionism said, we have always been abnormal because we have been a people without a land, a people without a state. Let's get rid of that abnormality. Let's be a nation like all the nations, have all the trappings of statehood. And with that, we will return to history, we will return to normality. But at the same time, it offered the promise of building a uniquely Jewish society. We don't now have to live on the margins of Gentile society. We can create our own culture, our uniquely Jewish culture. And then, therefore, these two trends seem to be reconciled. Zionism almost managed this, but not quite. And at least since 1967, perhaps it goes back earlier, you can look at a lot of the most critical events in Israeli history as expressing this tension, rather than simply calling it a left-wing versus a right-wing thing. For instance, let's just go back to an event that I'm not going to talk about later on, disengagement from Gaza in 2005, Gush Katif, traditionally called left-wing, right-wing. I think it's much simpler to think of it like this. If you are of the, let's start with the second one, Anachnu Kachol Hagoyim, normalization with the rest of the world, living our lives like the rest of the world, then 8,000 Israeli citizens in the midst of 1.5 million Palestinian Arabs, tremendous economic burden, tremendous military burden. This isn't the Israel we know. We're striving to be a normal first world democracy, capitalist, etc. Withdrawal from Gaza equals normalization, equals this is what Jewish history should be. But if you're on the other side of the debate, then exceptionalism is not something I don't want. Exceptionalism is what I signed up for. And these 8,000 Yishuvim, these 8,000 citizens living in Gush Katif, surrounded by hostile Arabs, are a metaphor for Israel itself, surrounded by hostile nations in the Middle East, which is itself a metaphor for the Jewish people throughout history, surrounded by hostile nations. So abnormality is what Jewish history is, so don't use that argument against us. That's the broad sort of theme that we're going to be coming back to at numerous points throughout this discussion. But the second one I want to take from a very different thinker, not a Jewish thinker, but an ancient Greek thinker. Anyone here who knew me at university, a few faces will know that this was one of my dear friends in my undergraduate years, a man called Thucydides. Nowadays, when I speak about Thucydides, I'm normally talking to Israelis about Thucydides. And anyone know how they say Thucydides in Hebrew? Tukidedes, which is quite endearing name. I mean, like, sort of, Thucydides is this hard-nosed, you know, sort of realist, you know, political type. Like, Tukidedes, you know, sounds like a parrot, etc. Anyway, Thucydides writes, maybe I should have bought it, what he's known as is his History of the Peloponnesian War. He's writing in the 5th century BCE, so a generation and a half before Plato. And this war is going on, by the standards of the ancient world, this very, very large war between Athens and Sparta and the allies of Athens and Sparta. And Thucydides, who at first is an Athenian general, then he loses the battle and he's expelled from Athens, and so he becomes a historian, he thinks he sees something in this conflict which is actually not just of interest for his own time, but is going to be of relevance throughout history. Something essential about human history is being captured in this war that he sees. It's what he thinks of as the first total war. It's not just between Athens and Sparta. It engulfs the whole, more or less the whole Mediterranean. It eventually ends up in Sicily and even gets to Egypt. One, I only want to focus, it's such a worthwhile book. It's an enormous book. If you haven't read it and you're interested in politics, I can't recommend reading it enough. There are people that say whole history of Western philosophy is a footnote to Plato, to which the response is, and Plato is a footnote to Thucydides. I just want to focus on one small... Sorry? Yeah. There are many translations of it. If you don't read ancient Greek, that's fine. I just want to focus on one small, really small instance within Thucydides, but which captures a larger theme. In book 3, the year is 427 BCE, Thucydides tells us about a small town called Corcyra. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. I think it's like that. Corcyra in English. And Corcyra is torn between different factions. It's a small city, torn between different factions. One faction which supports the Athenians and one faction which supports the Spartans. And both the Athenians and the Spartans are considering coming in to the city, but they stay, in fact, on the outside in order to wait and see what will happen in the city itself. And over the course of several months, the city tears itself apart and destroys itself, so there's actually no need for either of the large powers to come in. And for Thucydides, Corcyra captures the perfect instance of society in what the Greek word is, stasis. Stasis sort of captures the spectrum from just societal discontent to absolute all-out civil war. Civil war would be the highest peak of stasis. And Thucydides thinks that this, which he's seen so clearly in Corcyra, actually then replicates itself and happens again and again throughout the war and will continue to happen throughout human history. In Thucydides' reading, it's not something that's limited just to a specific political historical context. It's something that's part of human nature, part of human personality. And if that's so, then even if it's ancient Greece or modern Israel or anything in between, the two will continue from one another. Now, I've put at the back an appendix. I've put not even the full quote, but a large bit from it. I'm not going to read all of this now. It's for you in your own time, and the language is so beautiful that maybe you'll go and read the whole book. I've just picked out 4 instances. It's really a diagnostic model, right? In Greek thought at the time, sort of politics and science were considered to be part of the same thing. And just as you diagnose a medical condition, so do you diagnose something in politics. So Thucydides gives us a diagnostic model of stasis. How do we spot stasis? How do we highlight an instance where the society is on the way, possibly eventually to civil war, but certainly on the way to breaking down. So here are a few of the things I've picked out, 4 of them just from this piece that I've put at the back, but let's look at the first page. Already existing factions and tensions within a society will be exacerbated by the backdrop of a larger conflict, right? So we're looking at what's going on in a specific society, and those tensions may well have existed there for a long time. They may be deeply rooted with historical reasons, cultural reasons, etc. But when there is the backdrop of a larger conflict, these tensions already there in the society will come out and potentially be much more violent, much more extreme than they otherwise would have been. One reason for this is that each of the factions now has the potential for an ally with a much larger power, be it Athens, be it Corcyra. We'll go on to see some stuff in the 1940s, but just if you were in the last year, obviously in the case of Gedalia, the existence of the Babylonian Empire, the destruction of the temple, the potential that Egypt holds out, that is clearly something that we can see as a parallel. So that's the first one. Second one, what he calls language permutations. Words had to change their meaning and to take that which was now given to them. Okay, this is a fascinating idea. Language moves, language develops. What seems to, what one word means at a certain stage will go on to mean something else. If you turn to the just to the appendix where I put Thucydides, the large quote, I'll just read to you one paragraph. See the paragraph, the fourth one. Words had to change their ordinary meaning and to take that which was now given to them. Reckless audacity came to be considered the courage of a loyal ally. Prudent hesitation, specious cowardice. Moderation was held to be a cloak for unmanliness. Ability to see all sides of a question, inaptness to act on any. Frantic violence became the attribute of manliness. Cautious plotting, a justifiable means of self-defense. The advocate of extreme measures was always trustworthy. His opponent, a man to be suspected. So the value itself stays. Courage was a good thing beforehand, and it's a good thing afterwards. But what's taken to represent courage, that changes. Right? If courage beforehand could be considered, a considerate position, taking measures, but also being prudent, here it becomes frantic violence. So that now comes to be courage. We'll come back to Thucydides in a moment, but let's just jump forward into the 1920s. Third source on the first page, this letter from Gershom Scholem to Franz Rosenzweig. And it gives us an idea of the importance of language and how watching language and what words mean and the changing meaning of certain words and phrases is going to be a very clear and important way of putting our finger on potentially violent, potentially self-destructive rhythms. So Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Kabbalah, moves from Germany to Israel, pre-state Israel, in the 1920s, writing to his friend, the great theologian Franz Rosenzweig, back in Germany. Such a powerful source, this. The land is a volcano, and it hosts the language. People talk a great deal here about many things which may make us fail, particularly these days about the Arabs. You know what? I'm talking a lot. I'm not drinking today, and I'm going to carry on talking a lot. So does anyone want to take over from me for... the source?
The land is a volcano and it hosts the language. People talk a great deal here about many things which may make us fail, particularly these days about the Arabs. But another more serious danger than that of the Arab people threatens us, a danger which follows of necessity from the Zionist enterprise. What will be the result of updating the Hebrew language? Is not the Hebrew language which we have planted among our children an abyss that must open up? People here do not know the meaning of what they have done. They think they have turned Hebrew into a secular language and that they have removed its apocalyptic sting, but it is not so. The Hebrew language is pregnant with catastrophe. After invoking the ancient names day after day, we shall no longer be able to hold off their power. God cannot remain silent in a language in which he has been evoked thousands of times to return to our life.
What a source. I mean, you know, reading it 90 years later, it doesn't... anything, it's gained in its power. But you can see that what Scholem is putting his finger on is something that's already there in Thucydides. Watching language, watching the way in which words change is a very important indicator. Once this begins to happen, Thucydides tells us, when language permutations become moral disjunctions, social, religious, political, and legal conventions which bind the society break down. Now, there's no society which is completely united, obviously. Every society has got its disparate elements, its different ideas. But societies, nevertheless, do have institutions which are able to bridge those gaps and to bring people together despite their differences. What would you think of are the obvious ones in Israel? What is the, Israel's such a diverse society, what is the single institution above all that brings many Israelis together?
The army.
The army is the classic one, right? So that's the army. Watching how the IDF and the pre-IDF feature in this discussion is going to be a very interesting one. Even though majority of Israelis are not religious, nevertheless, the rabbinate has been a very important institution in nevertheless providing religious support and religious sanction from the days of Rav Kook in the 1930s onwards for the secular state of Israel. So that's also going to be another institution to watch. Finally, in stasis, the moderate and the intelligent leadership suffer. This is what I mentioned in the last class with Gedalia ignoring the warnings of those who were out to kill him, and as we're going to see, Rabin not paying attention to the warnings that he was receiving from the Shabak. The moderate part of the citizens perished between the two, either for not joining in the quarrel or because envy would not suffer them to escape. Society became divided into camps in which no man trusted his fellow, while their adversaries, this leadership I was speaking about, arrogantly thinking that they should know in time and that it was unnecessary to secure by action what policy afforded, often fell victims to their want of precaution. Okay, so these are our two introductions. The broad Jewish introduction, are we a nation that dwell alone or are we a nation like all the other nations? And Thucydides' diagnostic model, how do we see stasis, something that can start off as a societal dispute and eventually end up in full-scale civil war. So probably the most tumultuous period in Zionist history is the decade before independence, the 1940s prior to 1948. The Yeshuv is divided, broadly speaking, into two main groups and then some divisions. The Yeshuv is the name of the pre-state Jewish society in Palestine. Primarily, there is the Jewish Agency. The Jewish Agency, which is also connected to the Histadrut, to the trade unions. Chaim Weizmann, David Ben-Gurion are the political leadership of this, and its military wing is the Haganah, and its crack military group is the Palmach. In the 1920s, the revisionist movement has split off from the main Zionist body under the leadership of Jabotinsky. And after Jabotinsky's death in 1940, the revisionist movement itself splits into two military groups. The first one is the Irgun, also known as Etzel, under Menachem Begin. And then a smaller one, much smaller one, and really far to the right, known as Lehi, Lochmei Cherut Yisrael, Fighters, Warriors for the Freedom of Israel, under the leadership of Avraham Stern, also known as the Stern Gang. Now, throughout World War II, and here, of course, we have to think of the British, right? The British represent, in many ways, either the enemy or certainly the major international power that has to be dealt with from the Zionist perspective, right? The British come prior to thinking about the Nazis in many ways. However, during World War II, most of the armed groups put aside their differences in order to help with the war effort. This ends, however, in autumn 1944 due to severe British restrictions on immigration to Israel. Menachem Begin declares what he called the revolt, Hamered. There were bank robberies and attacks on government buildings. And in response to this, Ben-Gurion and the Jewish Agency launch a crackdown on the Irgun, arrests, handing them over to the British. Any doubts about doing this are dispelled when Lehi assassinate Lord Moyne, who's the British High Representative to Israel, close friend of Churchill. Now, all of this poses a great threat to the Jewish Agency and to the Haganah because it's challenging their policy of cooperating with the British on the one hand, and also seems to be challenging their leadership mantle. So they launched this massive crackdown on the Irgun. Trade Union Congress in Israel, November 22nd, 1944, resolves that Irgun members be thrown out of workplace and schools, denied hiding places, and handed over to the British, basically destroying the Irgun. Begin goes into hiding, refuses to be drawn into civil war. This ends with the end of World War II, a small period of post-war cooperation, 1945, first half of 1946. But then Begin and Lehi, once again frustrated with nothing moving in terms of independence, in terms of a British withdrawal, step up their campaign against the British once again. Sorry, I forgot to use the most important source, maybe, or not the most important, but perhaps the most extreme, the bottom one on the first page. This is during World War II. Lehi, who have been the only ones not to cooperate with the British, actually write to Nazi Germany, representatives of the Nazis, a number of times in order to request help, right? At the bottom, source, we wish to propose cooperation between the new Germany and the reborn Völkisch Nationalen Hebräten. And we offer active participation in the war on the German side on the condition that the aspirations of the Israeli freedom movement are recognized. Doesn't get more extreme than that, right? I mean, the enemy of your enemy is your friend, taken to the absolute most possible absurd extreme. If the British are our fundamental enemy who are preventing us from realizing our aspirations in Palestine, then as the Nazis are the enemy of the British, ergo they must be our allies. And luckily, the Nazis do not respond to, unsurprisingly, do not respond to this request. But already this gives us an idea of, you know, going back to Thucydides' idea, the larger conflict gives the possibility for these tensions to become far, far more exacerbated. Tom Segev, great Israeli historian, got a very good book about this period. He writes at this stage, anti-British terror was part of the battle for the control of the Yishuv and almost brought the Jews to civil wars. The way in which the different groups situate themselves in relation to the British is part of their battle against one another, really. 1947-1948, prospect of British withdrawal and all-out war against the Arabs, this now brings unification. Finally, the warring groups come together in order to pool their resources. Nevertheless, it's this period of unification which produces probably the most infamous of all events in Israeli history, right at the start, in terms of the event that led most closely to a civil war. June 20th, 1948, 2 weeks after the UN ceasefire, the Irgun are bringing a munitions ship called the Altalena from France. On board are 5,000 immigrants, 5,000 Olim, $5 million worth of ammunition, of weapons provided by France. Right, France are to the Irgun what Britain are to the Haganah, and what Nazi Germany possibly might have been for Lehi. Everyone has some international alliance. The ship comes to off the coast of Tel Aviv. Now, Begin is certainly not planning on an armed takeover, certainly not planning on an insurrection. His demands are that the choice weapons be given to Irgun units in the army and the Irgun fighters be given the symbolic honour of unloading the ship. Nevertheless, Ben-Gurion, who is a suspicious politician, if ever there was one, has put a huge premium on unity within the army, doesn't want any distinction whatsoever. He's also heard rumours of a potential uprising. He takes this to the cabinet and presents it as a plot against the leadership of the Yishuv. He's able to get clearance for a military response if the Irgun refuses to give itself up. The next day is stalemate. Begin by now is actually on board the ship. When they refuse to give in to a 10-minute ultimatum, Palmach units on the beach in Tel Aviv range their guns against the Altalena. Irgun units in the army desert and start moving towards Tel Aviv. These are the first casualties of the event, a standoff between regular units and Irgun units. Begin refuses to give in, and the order is given to open fire on the ship with the immigrants on it and all of the arms on it. Palmach units continue to fire even as people are in the water, even as white flags are raised. Begin is dragged off the ship. Altogether, 19 people are killed from the ship. This is the moment that Israel came closest, right at year zero, to civil war. And it's going to go on to haunt Israel for many, many years afterwards. We'll come back to this at the end. It was really only Begin's insistence on not responding that averted all-out civil war. Anybody know who the Palmach commander on the beach in Tel Aviv was? Yitzhak Rabin, right? Young 26-year-old Yitzhak Rabin. He was the commander on the beach. I don't want to spend too long. Sorry?
My father was on the beach and watched it happen.
Really?
And my cousin, Bishacha, who'd been a student in Jewish college, had gone to Israel to fight. and was on the boat. And I was saying the same thing. And I was like, because I was, you know, learning Jewish history is like historical. They'd both been there in that situation.
Wow.
Amazing. Amazing story.
So I don't want to dwell on this for too long, but I want to just make a couple of points. Firstly, we've seen, going back to Thucydides, the potential that the wider conflict gives. And just in terms of language permutations, there are some absolutely amazing examples of secular, really, you know, anti-religious Zionist leaders, especially of the Haganah and Palmach, using absolutely astonishing religious language. Here's Ben-Gurion at the top of page 2. Blessed is the gun which exploded this ship. When we build the temple, that gun should be placed near its main gate. Right? That gives an astonishing insight. And I mean, something I want to sort of flag up at this point, I really don't want this year to be seen, even though obviously at the end it's going to move in that direction, to be seen a history of violence in modern Israel means how crazy religious right-wingers have been violent. Right? That's a distortion of the overall spread of Israeli history. Obviously, there have been very significant instances of it, the Rabin assassination being the worst, but the spread throughout Israeli history is shared equally, and if there's one event which came closest to civil war, it was the Altalena. Now, why have I chosen Haredi violence? Partly because in order to contrast with, firstly, everyone, modern Orthodox or non-Haredi people love talking about Haredim, right? It's like our favourite thing. How terrible Haredim are. Not because of that. Really, I want to do it in order to show the contrast with the other sorts of political violence that we're talking about. Because in a very important sense, Haredi violence is not political. Or rather, maybe better put, it's not historical. Haredi world is a very diverse world. What is it that unites it? On the one hand, it's adherence to halakha. More than that, it's absolute rejection of modernity, and specifically in the Israeli context, it's absolute theological rejection of Zionism. It's not just that we're not Zionists, but we see Zionism as an assault on divine history. We are in the destruction of the Second Temple wasn't just a tragedy, it was a maybe it wasn't a tragedy at all, it was punishment for our sins, and we as Am Yisrael are supposed to wait in exile until the time that God sees fit to bring us back to Israel. Any attempt to come back to Israel, to rebel against the nations, that is forcing the end. That is an anti-religious plan. So, for the most part, the Haredim in the early years insulated themselves from and separated themselves from what was going on. That was the fundamental approach, separation. Leave us alone, let us live our own lives. At certain points in the 50s, separation does have to move into protest. The iconic figure in Haredi protest is a man called Rav Amram Blau, who was the lead figure of Neturei Karta. Right? People familiar with Neturei Karta for their violent anti-Zionism. The Neturei Karta are a central group. The Eda Haredit are another one that we'll come back to. The famous ones are the Shabbat protests of the 1950s. Protesting against transportation and cars driving through Mea Sharim, the Jerusalem Haredi neighborhood, on Shabbat. They normally start off as quite small demonstrations, yelling Shabbos, Shabbos. When the police responded, often with quite significant brutality, then the hundreds and the thousands came out. It took 5 years for eventually the Jerusalem municipality to issue a law banning transport on Shabbat through that part of Jerusalem. And if anybody's ever gone to Mea Sharim, you'll know Kikar Shabbat, which is the central sort of crossroads of Mea Sharim, which is named after those demonstrations.
Hashem rules the world.
Well, the religious mind always has multiple ways of, many ways of being able to read history, and when history contradicts what your theology is, either you change your theology, or the other option is to provide a new reading of that history. This is further punishment. This is further zrizut, further pushing us in order to maintain our faith against it, etc. So, there were many Orthodox Jews who may well have been swayed by the anti-Zionist arguments of the early 20th century, who, seeing events as they turned out, moved towards a more moderate or religious Zionist perspective. But certainly the Haredi camp has been able to hold it to its interpretation of history. I'm interested really in sort of the extreme elements of it. The vast majority of the Haredi world is not even so much involved in protest. It's changed somewhat over the last year, even with regards to the army draft. The real hardcore has been a group called the Eda Haredit. Now, the Eda Haredit and their followers are far too against modernity even to read Haredi newspapers. So, what's been the classic, and I'm sure many of you have seen, but it's worth looking at some just for examples, what's been the way of speaking to the masses in order to rally them to come out and protest has been what's called the Pashkavil. Right? The Pashkavil is a black-on-white text. It's put up on the walls of Mea Shearim. I've printed out a few you can take and pass around. Put up on the walls of Mea Shearim or B'nai Brak, other neighbourhoods, always put up on Erev Shabbat, because as obviously we all know, you're not allowed to tear down posters on Shabbat, so everybody has to read it on Shabbat.
Why is it called Pashkavil?
Pashkavil, I don't know the etymology of the word. Anybody know it? So there are a few ones here which capture things. Well, here's, you can see them going around. There's one saying, protesting against desecration of what might have been thought to be an ancient Jewish gravesite. And so it says on it, we would prefer Shilton Aravi, Mishilton Yehudi. We'd prefer an Arab government to a Jewish government, an Arab government which would at least respect Jewish gravesite. What's amazing about that is, other than really politically you'd want that, but is that it shows that there's no aspiration whatsoever for their own government, right? They're not a political group in the sense of ever envisaging their own rule over the state. You see the amazing demonization. What's the Tzava one? Somebody read it. The Tzahal. Right, Tzava HaMavet LiYisrael. Tzahal, the abbreviation for the Israeli army. The IDF goes from being the army of the Israel Defense Forces to the army of the death of Israel. That's been part of the current campaign against IDF enrollment. This is my favorite one over here. This is the campaign against the internet, maintaining separation. Internet mevik sartan, internet leads to cancer, with the proof being internet equals the gematria of 319, which is also the gematria of sartan, cancer. No, you're not sold, though, because the lovely thing about this is that the only way they could get to 319 was by dropping the yud from internet, which is how internet is spelt in Hebrew, aleph yud, so it becomes antenet. So make sure none of you use the antenet, because could lead to cancer. It does come out true. Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
Does it work for ancient words?
Sorry?
Does it work for ancient
yeah.
words?
Them too. And we'd be wrong if we didn't mention actual intra-Haredi violence, which sometimes goes to significant extremes. But before we mention it, before I want to mention a specific case study, it's important to realise what this is not. We have astonishing, as harsh verbal language as can be imagined. I see some of you looking at the Nazi picture, right? There are, Judy's holding it up here. Picture of kids in concentration camps in the 1940s, and ones of Haredi youth being kidnapped and being put in prison by the Zionist authorities. Today, since the 1950s, certain Haredi demonstrators have worn yellow stars at demonstrations. They are the inheritors of, they are the traditional historical Jewish people, persecuted throughout history, be it the Crusaders, be it the Nazis, be it the Zionist authorities. So this is such extreme and such, you know, from our point of view, vile imagery, but appreciate what it is not. There is such a taboo against actual violence. Nobody has ever been killed in any Haredi demonstration, ever leading to any violence. Once in the 1950s, one man was killed, police brutality, or he was already ill, but a real significant exception. Ricky?
That, the Arab boy.
That's somewhat different in terms of the political context. They are, we'll come to that, but I mean in terms of organised political Haredi action. The Chazon Ish in the 1940s was tremendously against the owning of firearms. I think it's a very important thing to point out. Sometimes, you know, I saw a Facebook status just yesterday, Jews should stop complaining about Islamic fundamentalists and concentrate on their own, and it was a Telegraph article about a flight from New York to Tel Aviv being held for 11 hours because the large Haredi population on the plane didn't want to sit next to women. I mean, yeah, like, you know, they're crazy, they're wrong, they should live in the modern world, but it's not a coincidence that they don't kill. It is embedded deep within their ideology and needs to be given a lot of respect to that despite the tremendous onslaught onto their worldview, violence has always been rejected. And sometimes the lack of the violent option then leads to tremendous creativity in their internal fights. Here's probably the most famous one. In 1980, Bells Hasidim split off from the Eda Haredit. The Eda Haredit, which was sort of the umbrella organization of the more extreme elements within the Haredi world. It split off because the head of the Eda Haredit, Rav Weiss, issued a ruling that nobody who was under his system could receive funding from the state for their educational activities. Now, Bells, after the Holocaust, having been almost completely diminished, completely destroyed, had rebuilt itself in Israel, a very successful education system, and had received much money from the government, could not agree to this. So it broke off from the Eda Haredit. It established all its own institutions to replace those of the Eda Haredit, its new system of Batei Dinim, courts of law, a new newspaper, Hamachaneh HaCharedi, a new kashrut, new school system, etc. So this posed a tremendous challenge to the Eda and its authority. Rav Rokach, he was the Bell's Admor behind this. I'm reading now from Sprinzak, who I put up there. When Rabbi Rokach, the Bell's Admor, visited the United States in 1980, a number of death threats were made by Satmar Hasidim to him. The threats were taken so seriously that the FBI was requested to provide security for the besieged rabbi. Upon his return to Jerusalem, Rabbi Rokach was welcomed by huge Pashkavils, announcing, amongst other things, that Bell's in Gematria means Sodom, right? You can use Gematria for everything. A cartoon posted in neighborhood synagogues depicted bear fur around the rabbi's body. Dov, his first name means bear in Hebrew, and horns on his forehead. When Bells established an independent shechita slaughter system, the Haredi streets were full of Pashkavils, suggesting that Bells is not kosher, and that he who has eaten meat from Bells must re-kosher all of his dishes. Grave family problems ensued. Bell's sons studying in Adas schools could no longer eat at their parents' tables. Bell's students responded by phoning Rabbi Weiss, the head of the Eda Haredit, cursing him and sending diaper services to his home. It gets much worse. The Bells also bugged Rabbi Weiss's telephone lines. The internecine hatred became so intense that Eda activists ordered by phone two prostitutes to Rabbi Rokach's home. Rokach's followers responded by sending bread to Weiss's home in the middle of Pesach. After this point, Bells were put under full economic excommunication and fist fights broke out amongst yeshiva students. You've got to wonder about the prostitutes, you know. What on earth, like, do they really think it was a real call that was sending them to deep Meir Sharon? But so, well, So what's amazing about that is, you know, sort of the creativity that is unleashed in this rivalry, because actual real significant violence is taboo and is off the table. Why is it off the table? Lo tirtzach, do not kill. The sense of Jews do not do violence, and that a Jewish life is always a Jewish life nonetheless. And I would add to it the non-historical context. They are not caught in this tension of, are we a people that dwell alone and that's our historical destiny, or are we a nation like all the nations, unlike those who are part of the Zionist movement, whether to the left or to the right, are caught up in it. And this brings us to the 1990s and Rabin. A little bit of background, I'm sure very many of you are familiar. If in the 1930s and 40s the tension between left and right was between the Irgun, Menachem Begin, and the revisionists on the one hand, and Ben Gurion and the Haganah and the Jewish Agency on the other, post 1967 the left-right divide takes on very new meaning. Massive new territories conquered after 1967. And the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the Gush Emunim movement, Messianic religious Zionist movement, which sees the redemptive Messianic process as being intimately tied to Jewish settlement of all of biblical Israel, that becomes the major new impetus on the right side of the spectrum of Israeli politics. Of course, you still do have the secular right wing, the Likud, comes to power in 1977, but for our purposes, that's what the introduction of Gush Emunim, of the religious Zionist right. Religious Zionism until 67 had been moderate to the left, had always been part of the Labour government's facts of religious Zionist history that people aren't aware of. Rav Cook in the early 1900s was in favour of the Uganda Plan. In 1967, the Mafdal, the religious Zionist party, was the only party in the cabinet to vote against a preemptive strike against Egypt. And all of this changes after 1967. And again, this is also very tied up to the question of Jewish exceptionalism. Is this what Israel is about? Versus acceptance into the family of nations. The critical breakthrough moment for the Gush Emunim settler movement in the 1970s, prior to 1975, the settlements had been quite small. They'd been in areas with very little Palestinian population, in quite undisputed areas. But the attempt to really settle in Arab-Palestinian heartlands, that's wait until the 1970s, a famous standoff at an old railway station called Sebastia, the attempt to settle, make a permanent settlement there. And the government, Yitzhak Rabin's government, resisting it. But the breaking point for the Rabin government, which pushed them to accept it, was that at that very moment, the UN passed its resolution declaring that Zionism is racism, which there was the Labour government surrounded on both sides by groups saying Jews are unique, Jews are exceptional, the UN saying that Zionism was racism, and the Gush Emunim movement saying this is our historical destiny. So we see already at the beginning of the post-67 period this existential question, Bilam versus Shmuel, coming in. 1980s, Palestinian Intifada. 1990s, relations with Jordan, relations with Egypt. Israeli GDP goes up massively, and Israel seems to be entering really into sort of first world status. And when Rabin presents the Oslo plan to Israel, to the Knesset, normalizing relations with the Palestinians, recognition of Yasser Arafat's PLO, giving the PLO autonomy and authority over Gaza and large parts of the West Bank, he doesn't just present it as a political moment, he presents it as an existential moment. This is obviously a gift for me, this quote, the top quote in the Rabin section on page 2. Rabin speaking to the Knesset in 1993. No longer are we a people that dwells alone. We are no longer an Am Levadad Yishkon. And no longer is it true that the whole world is against us. We must overcome the sense of isolation that has held us in its thrall for almost half a century. So Rabin himself presents this as a very great existential moment. And much of the moderate and the articulate response from the right is an argument against this. So Rav Yoel ben Nun, who is a fascinating figure, a teacher of mine, and plays a very central role in this period, he is quoted at the time as beseeching the Rabin government and the peace movement, do not build your dreams on the ruin of our dreams, right? Even if things are going to change, find some way of not making the victory of one ideological option be the absolute destruction of another one. So there's parliamentary opposition, there's the Likud opposition to Rabin's plan, and there's the extra parliamentary, right? The non-political, those on the more extremes. And one thing that becomes very clear right from the start is the way in which the Rabin government comes to be viewed as being part of the historical continuity and trajectory of all of Israel's enemies throughout history. After the Rabin assassination, many people asked, how did we not see this coming? There were so many signs on the wall. And one very significant reason seems to be this false consciousness that Jews throughout history are the passive victims, right? Jews are always acted upon, be it by Babylonians, Romans, Crusaders, Tony Soprano, etc., right? That seems to be, but nevertheless, this idea of the eternal enemy, the eternal anti-Semite, and this comes back to Thucydides' language permutations, turns inward, right, and is used against opponents on the inside. So Ariel Sharon and Rechavam Tzvi, right, important Likud politicians, accuse Sharon and Haaretz of shrinking Israel to the size of Auschwitz. Here's Eliakim Haetzni. Haetzni is an interesting man. He's an attorney, Kiryat Arba. He's sort of part of the bridge between the parliamentary legal opposition and the illegal opposition. Here's him writing in Nekuda, a magazine of the settler movement, 1994. Somebody want to read? Rise up and act.
We have done nothing. Protests, demonstrations, tent cities, even setting up roadblocks are insufficient against a government engaged in national treason. In France, defeated in 1940 when Marshal Pétain gave in to Hitler and made an alliance with him, just as Lieutenant General Rabin did by shaking Yasser Arafat's dirty hand, De Gaulle not demonstrate in protest. Although the regime was born in a democratic way, he deserted, rebelled against a Nazi army of collaboration. That is why I am saying loud and clear, an IDF soldier, though Jewish, who would pull us, our wives, our children from our houses and make us refugees, will, in our view, be conducting a pogrom. We shall look upon him as a violent thug behaving like a Cossack. It is no secret that all through Israel's glorious history, there were dark and shameful chapters in which Jews beat, tortured, turned in, and even put to death their brothers. And leaders have led their followers to disaster.
And what was Pétain's end? Right. He was assassinated, right? You know, he doesn't make it explicit, but Haetzni, but it's already there, pregnant in the text itself. So all sorts of these sort of metaphors are being used. But Haetzni becomes more famous really because of his posters rather than his writings. This is one of the most famous ones over here, right? It's Yasser Arafat's kafirim, but it's actually Rabin's face on it, Hashakran, the liar. This is just one of many posters that Haetzni produced, and these become at the main anti-Oslo, anti-Rabin government rallies, which brings together both the legitimate opposition and the illegal, well, not the illegal, but the extra-parliamentary opposition. So in 1994, at a rally which Sharon and Netanyahu speak at, an effigy of Rabin wearing an SS uniform is paraded in a coffin. You get the put in the coffin. You get the then he's burnt. So you get the mixing of these things. Very importantly, February 1994, Purim 1994, a Kiryat Arba doctor, Baruch Goldstein, American immigrant, student of Rav Meir Kahana, the founder of Kach, Davins early in a minyan in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, dressed in his miluim, his army reservist uniform, sneaks into the Muslim, into the Islamic prayer hall in the Cave of Patriarchs in Hebron, opens fire 5:10 in the morning, waiting for all of them to be bowing down on the floor so that they've got almost no chance against him. 29 are killed. A cog in his rifle catches as he loads the fifth cartridge, and those who haven't been injured manage to throw a fire extinguisher at him and eventually beat him to death. This is a massive act of violence. Very importantly, it's portrayed both by Rabin and by the Yesha Council, the main settlement group, as being the act of a madman. Right? This is the act of a lone psychopath. He is not part of us. He is a complete aberration. And although in many ways, in retrospect, we can understand why it was attractive to call him a lone psychopath, that also ends up not addressing the actual philosophical and ideological ideas that are lying behind him, and not realizing that, in fact, even though it's only part of a minute group who are thinking these things politically and willing to act on it, nevertheless, all you need is a very minute group. Nevertheless, the government consider pulling out early from Tel Rumeida. Tel Rumeida is a hill in the center of Hebron. If Hebron is the real storm of the conflict, then Tel Rumeida is the eye of the storm. It's seven families, which has a whole army unit guarding them permanently in the middle of Hebron. They consider pulling out from this, which sends a real, real shock through the anti-Rabin camp. Hebron has never been discussed as part of the pullout at this stage. Various rabbis, Rav Goren, the first chief rabbi of the Israeli army in the 1950s, the 1940s, the chief rabbi of Israel in the 70s and 80s, along with Rav Shapira and Rav Yisraeli, who are the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Arav, the great religious Zionist institution, issue a halachic position calling on soldiers to disobey orders. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this idea of salbanut, of refusing orders, but this is the first time that it's ever said at this point in the early 90s. And again, going back to Thucydides, this idea of the central institutions which bind losing their pull, losing their confidence. Although there may have been very few soldiers who actually would have disobeyed orders, nevertheless, the message it sent to the Israeli public, the Israeli army losing its rabbinic religious sanction, becomes very significant. Massive rallies continuing. The mainstream opposition to Oslo, also some very extreme things are gathering pace. Dead doves are sent to the Rabin family on a regular basis. Even in mid-1995, a small group conduct the Pulsa Dinura outside of Rabin's home. The Pulsa Dinura is a mystical, very little known Kabbalistic death curse put upon somebody, shrouded in mystery. Literally, Pulsa Dinura means a shot of fire. This is the text of it. Angels of destruction will hit him. He is damned wherever he goes. His soul will instantly leave his body, and he will not survive the month. Dark will be his path, and God's angel will chase him. A disaster he has never experienced will beget him, and all curses known in the Torah will apply to him. Now, obviously, this is only a minute group doing this. But this sort of thing is never, ever done. This is not something that's done regularly. The Pulsa Dinura comes with the sub-clause that if the person it's put upon is not actually guilty, then the Pulsa Dinura will fall back upon those who have done the curse. That people are willing to do this really shows you just how significant the opposition is. But here's the final point that I want to focus on. February 1995 is the one-year anniversary of the Goldstein massacre in Hebron. Kach has been banned, and so the actual memorial service for for Baruch Goldstein is relatively muted, but over the period of that year, a sort of shrine and cult has grown up around Baruch Goldstein, and the one-year anniversary, for the anniversary, a 535-page book collection of essays is released, called, for all you B'nai Akivaniks, Baruch HaGeber. Its headline piece is by a man called Rav Yitzchak Ginzburg, interesting figure, still active in Israeli life. He urges his readers to be more forgiving, think more broadly about Baruch Goldstein, think of the positive aspects of it. It's there's aspects of revenge, which is a good thing. There's aspects of Mesirat Nefesh for the land of Israel, etc., etc. And in terms of the halachic question, can you kill non-Jews? Here he is, Rav Ginzburg, the second to last source on page 2. About the value of Israel's life, it simply seems that the life of Israel is worth more than the life of the Gentile. And even if the Gentile does not intend to hurt Israel, it is permissible to hurt him in order to save Israel. In a situation in which there is danger, even remote, that the Gentile will operate, even if indirectly to hurt Israel, there is no need to care about him. We are consequently taught that the war referred to is not necessarily a real battle, but even a situation of national conflict justifies such killing. Now, most of the articles in this massive compendium are about the Jews and the Arabs and the conflict and the need to be strong against it. There's one article, though, which really, in many ways, is the most interesting article, perhaps the most disturbing article, and seems to, in many ways, hold the key to Yigal Amir. This book, Baruch HaGeber, was one of only three books found in Yigal Amir's room when the police searched it afterwards. This article that I'm referring to is written by Binyamin Zev Kahana, the son of Rav Meir Kahana, and it is the only article in the book which doesn't really talk about the Arabs as the enemy, but really the Jews as the enemy. Somebody want to read it?
The problem is not the Arabs, the problem is the Jews. The truth, the way we look at it, is that there's never been an Arab problem. We could have solved the problem in 48 hours if only we wanted to. The real war is not with the Arabs, but with the Hellenized Jews. All the blood shed by Arab terrorism is as if shed by the Arabs. The people really responsible for the bloodshed are Jews scared by the Gentiles and attached to distorted Western ideas. Today's cultural war is more intense than the Hasmonean one. Hellenization has deeply penetrated our lives, and its ideas have influenced even the nationalist and religious public. The moment of truth has arrived. One option is to follow the path of Judaism, the entire Jewish idea, to reject the fear of the Gentile, Western democracy, and the idea of coexistence with the Arabs. This way is the condition for the existence of a Jewish state. The other option is acceptance of the yoke of democracy and giving up the dream of a Jewish state. There is no third way.
Thanks, Alex. And what becomes so clear in that quote when you put it in the next to the previous quote from Rav Yitzchak Ginzburg, if you are Yigal Amir, a radicalized student active in these camps, the line between murder of Gentiles and murder of Jews is drawn very clearly, moving from the Goldstein massacre to the assassination of Rabin in that conceptual move. And you couldn't really have anything more explicit than this source that Alex has just read of the other side of this Bilam versus Shmuel antithesis that has been with us throughout history. If Rabin has presented the Oslo Accords as no longer are we a nation that dwells alone, we are no longer Am Levadad Yishkon, then this is the absolute, ultimate refutation and argument against that, that says this is what we have always been, and our true enemies are not the Midianites, are not the Romans, are not the Nazis, are not the Arabs, are not the Palestinians. They are those Jews who think that our historical goal is to be a nation like all the other nations. November 1995, Rabin is finishing a massive peace rally in a Kikar Malchei Yisrael, Kings of Israel Square in Tel Aviv. Amir has had no difficulty hiding in the car park and shoots him at close range. The first time in thousands of years since Gedalia that a Jewish leader has been a Jewish leader of a Jewish group in the land of Israel has been assassinated. how do we conclude? Perhaps one very immediate point, which was just both a response to Gedalia and a response to Rabin, is found in Yechezkel Lamed Gimel. If you've got your Tanakhs there, you can open up Yechezkel chapter 33. Remember, Yechezkel lives himself during the time of the destruction of the first temple, and if Gedalia is the She'erit, the remnant that remains in Israel, then Yechezkel is with chapter 33 in Yechezkel. Yechezkel is with the exiled communities in Babel, hearing of the destruction of the temple. May well have also been hearing of the assassination of Gedalia. If you've got chapter 33, it's verse 23. So 33:23, Lamed Gimel Kaf Gimel. Lechein emor elohem. Therefore say to them, Ko amar. Chapter 33, verse 23. Adonai Elohim, thus does Lord the God say, Al hadam tochelu, you will eat the blood, you eat upon the blood, ve'einechem tisu al giluleichem, and you raise your eyes to your idols, ve'dam tishbechu, and you spill blood, ve'haaretz tirashu, and you think you will inherit the land. Amadatem al charbechem, you stand upon your swords, asiten to'eva, you perform such abominations, ve'ishet eshet re'ehu timetem, each man sleeps with his fellow's wife, v'ha'aretz tirashu, and you think that you will inherit the land. Sorry, pardon me, I started reading two verses late, didn't I? Sorry, we'll skip those verses, but back in 23, v'hidavar Hashem elai le'mor, the word of God came to me saying, Ben Adam, yoshvei hecharavot ha'ele al admat Yisrael, you who live in the wastelands of Israel, omrim le'mor, saying, Echad haya Avraham. Abraham was a single man. Ve'yirashit ha'aretz, and he inherited the land. Ve'anachnu rabim, and we are many. Lanu nitna ha'aretz l'mor asher. The land has been given to us and as an inheritance. Therefore say to these people, the verses that we read, you eat the blood, you live upon your sword, and yet you think that you will inherit the land. Therefore say to them, Ko amar Adonai Elohim, chay ani as I live, im lo asher b'charavot b'cherev yipolu, you will fall upon the sword, v'asher l'pnei asadeh l'chaya, those who fall upon the seal, upon the field will be taken by the wild beasts, natati lo'achlo, I have given them to eat, etc., etc. I won't read it now, but if you want to read Yeshayahu Leibovitz's absolute invective quoting these verses from Yechezkel there on page 3, his argument against the Gush Emunim group. This was prior to Rabin's assassination, many years, but it's the same argument. But regardless of which stage in history we're talking about, the left-right division, whether we're talking about pre-state or whether we're talking about the 1990s, it seems to be that Yechezkel's imagery and Yechezkel's prophecy is the final response to those who use violence in order to attain their ends, Jews against Jews, that the use of such violence immediately invalidates the claim to one's goals. The means do not justify the ends. But overall, even though this might not have seemed the tenor of it, what seems to me to be the absolute theme is that Israel never actually descended into civil war. That whether it be the Altalena in 1948 or whether it be the assassination of Rabin in 1995, what is amazing is that this was not the trigger for all-out civil war, but in many ways seemed to mark the high water tide. Madrachim of mine, who were teenagers in 1995, wearing kippot sregot, knitted kippot in Israel at the time, told me that people would cross the street rather than walk on the same side of the road. And religious, secular tensions were at their absolute height at that point. And I think if we look at where we are today, next year will be 20 years from Rabin's assassination. Yeah, there haven't been any answers to the big questions. The left's vision of peace has obviously not been fulfilled. The right's argument also seems to have had, has not necessarily succeeded. We're not necessarily any further along on that one. But in many ways, Rabin's murder did serve as a high watermark. Just to give a simple political analogy, so the last election, Yair Lapid becoming the sort of secular king of Israel, but the famously the son of the terribly anti-clerical Tommy Lapid. But Lapid could not have won his 19 seats without having a religious Zionist rabbi, Shai Piron, at number 2, and having a Haredi rabbi at number 16, and having a secular woman who has built her whole life teaching Torah to the secular public at number 9 on the list. And Naftali Bennett could not have become the all-conquering king of religious Zionist Israel without having a Tel Aviv Chilonit woman, Ayelet Shaked, very high up on his list, who is really the public face of the Jewish Home Party. And so in many ways, the 20 years internally, the 20 years since Rabin's assassination, have actually seen in many ways, I think, a lot of progress. And if we're speaking in LSJS, this is also very much true on a Limud Torah point of view. A place where I was very very lucky to spend a year studying, Bet Morasha, under the leadership of a man called Binyamin Ish Shalom, was one of the central places, along with many other places, of post-Rabin's assassination, saying, let's bring these texts, these Torani texts, which are seen by the mass of the secular public to be so decisive, let's bring them into public conversation, let's give the secular public an entrance into them, let them have a say in it themselves. Maybe let's finish with Begin. Begin, in many ways, for me, is the hero of the story. Begin's refusal to fire back in 1948, speaking to a professor of mine at Cambridge who was not an Israel expert, but was a politics expert, and who I spoke about this a lot with, he said to me, Professor Hawthorne said to me, that to the best of his knowledge, he does not know of any other instances in history of an armed group being fired upon by its rival and withholding fire and not firing back, but seeing its group and seeing all of its resources absolutely destroyed. And here is Begin, this is from his biography, speaking about the decision to the command to his troops not to fire back. We said civil war never. A cruel fratricidal war was actually waged all over the country. But this was a one-sided fratricidal war. And here was the key for the entire situation. The choice was between a disaster for us alone or a disaster for the entire nation. You know when a two-sided fratricidal war begins, but you never know where it will end. The command not to fight back came from somewhere from the depths of Jewish history. It was obeyed. To avoid bloody civil war at all costs. This principle, tempered in the sufferings of the season, we observed years later in the test of blood and fire of the Altalena. And so it came to pass that there was no fratricidal war in Israel to destroy the Jewish state before it was properly born. In spite of everything, there was no civil war. And if Rafi gave his own reading of why Tzom Gedalia, this historical political day, is here in this part of Yamim Nora'im, seemingly not devoted to historical political issues, I'm just to give my own very, very short one. This is the great dualism of Jewish history, that on the one hand we have the historical political element, the Jewish people, the land of Israel, but on the other hand we have the religious element, the people and their relationship with Hashem, the individual and their relationship with Hashem. And yet it seems to be that although you can pretty clearly say one part of the calendar is one thing and the other calendar is the other part of the calendar is the other thing, nevertheless there is always a little nod to the other. So Pesach, which is the liberation from slavery, the ultimate political event of our history, nevertheless has with it its element and its idea of its religious significance in terms of the relationship between Am Yisrael and Hashem. And the same is true with the opposite, right? These two heads of the Jewish year, Nisan and Tishrei. If the Tishrei, the year that begins with Tishrei, is the spiritual beginning of the year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, nevertheless, the tradition cannot allow there to be a period of the Jewish year which is solely focused on the spiritual idea without having a nod to the essential ideas, the obligations, the thoughts of the political historical side. And that is this little day of Tzom Gedalia at this point, which perhaps turns our attention from the universalist idea of Rosh Hashanah praying to the world to our own self-introspection, Cheshbon Nefesh of Yom Kippur, and does so via this event of Gedalia, which reminds us of the terrible event, but also in many ways perhaps has served as the point at which it does not get any worse than that, and that civil war has not been a reality. Shana Tova, everybody.
thank you very much for that wonderful share. The way the two put together represents very much what LSS is about, that religious and political and contextual study of our sources. Lots to think about. If there are just a few small factors, if you haven't given your £10 for this year, put your name here and hand it in. I'm giving a share this week on Preparation Yom Kippur on Tuesday, and there's just courses starting which you might be interested in. And if you're really crazy, then I won't agree to it. But tonight I'm talking to a Buddhist and JW3. So if you're interested in that, it's some universal stuff, you can go over to that. Joe, thank you very much. Please come and teach for us very soon.
Women's Bet Midrash tomorrow.
Good morning. And
11 a.m.
9:30.
Chevrutah, Shear 11.
Absolutely. And then next one after that?
Next one after that, Manchester Wednesday.
There you go. Thank you very much. Shalom to everybody. And Joe, thank you very much. So, you've given your 10